Hello there, I'm Jason Schulman, and this is New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies. My guest today on the podcast is Jenny Coleman. She is a senior lecturer and director of academic programs in the College of Humanities and Social Sciences at Massey University. She's here to talk about her new book, Polly Plum, A Firm and Earnest Woman's Advocate, Mary Ann Coakley, 1836 to 1885. It's published by Otago University Press in 2017. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Jason.
Well, it's great to have you on. So, Jenny, how did you discover and become interested in this fascinating figure, Polly Plum?
Well, I first read about her when I was doing my doctoral studies, which is way back in the early 1990s. I was reading a thesis on a social portrait of Auckland in the early 1870s, and here was this woman, Polly Plum, who appeared in the newspapers at the time. I was absolutely fascinated with her and decided to incorporate her in my PhD as one of the early advocates of women's rights in New Zealand.
And so this book is a biography of Polly Plum, who was the Mary Ann Coakley used in some of her writings. The biography tells the story of one of New Zealand's earliest feminists. Why was she so long forgotten?
I think a lot of her activism was basically through her newspaper journalism and her public lectures. So it was published in the newspapers, but as an entity, she left Auckland after some years and then seemed to disappear from the face of the public. So by the time she died, she was relatively obscure. And that, I think, with not being able to access the sources in the newspapers easily, she just disappeared from view.
So let's talk a little bit about who she was. How did the name Polly Plum come about?
Oh, there's several stories about how that name came about. She said that it was when she was doing newspaper journalism. At the time, the newspaper proprietor was Vogel, Julius Vogel, who was an important member of parliament in New Zealand, very influential. He was proprietor at the time and she was working for him. And he suggested that she use the name because it had a nice kind of ring to it. I think that's the official version.
Mm-hmm. So before we get into the story of her life, just generally, you mentioned that she'd been forgotten, that the end of her life she kind of disappeared. What did people think of her during her lifetime, though, in the 19th century?
Some people thought she was fabulous, but most people thought she was a bit of a rabble-rouser. She was very hard-hitting with what she said. She was a polite person, but she got more and more kind of radical, I guess, more confident, particularly as she was writing in the newspapers under a pen name. So she had a degree of anonymity. But then when she took to the public stage in lectures, people were more divided. Some thought that she was just a member of the shrieking sisterhood, was the phrase they used to use at the time, but others thought she was a breath of fresh air.
Let's talk a little bit about her early life. Where did she grow up and in what circumstances? And were those the type of circumstances that, one would predict would turn someone into kind of a radical and feminist?
She grew up in Clerkenwell in London. She was born in 1836 to a middle-class family. Her father was a builder. He owned a carpentry business, and at one stage he employed up to 22 people, so it was a reasonably substantial business. And it was at a time where there was a lot of building happening in London, so a very good time in history to have a building business. He was also very strongly of the opinion that girls should be educated, and Mary Ann's mother was French. She was well educated. We don't know very much about her apart from that, but Mary Ann had a reasonably comfortable upbringing, and I think that in itself wouldn't lend to someone becoming radical, but things changed quite considerably in her adult life and in her married life, and that is the turning point, I think, for her.
Mary Ann comes to New Zealand, as the book kind of opens with, and what happens to kind of shift her mind to become more interested in advocacy, and what motivated her?
Well, as a young child, she was very observant, and she does recount some childhood memories and growing up where she noticed that the way things were working, particularly for the daughters and families, wasn't really very fair. So these were in the back of her mind. For her, she came over to New Zealand with her brother, her younger brother. Mary-Ann was aged 21, but he didn't survive the journey over. It would seem that he may have gambled away the savings that the two of them brought with them. So when she arrived in New Zealand, she didn't have a male chaperone and she didn't have any money. And so she very quickly had to turn on her own wits and her strengths, which were in teaching, and basically make a living for herself. So immediately she was here, she was thrown into being both an independent woman as well as being someone who didn't have the backup, even if she wanted it, of someone to support her. So things started to change from that point.
Mary-Ann was interested in a range of issues. Two of the kind of main ones I thought that were fascinating were girls' education, which, as you mentioned, was important to her dad and to her growing up, and also working on behalf of women's prisoners. So what kind of tack did she take in both of those advocacy fields?
At the time, it was quite common for there to be a lot of discussion about girls' education and what was needed. Of course, there were two schools of thought generally. One was the conservative one, that girls didn't really need a lot of education because they were going to be wives and mothers. But others who wanted changes used that as an argument to increase girls' education. So she was of the opinion that, yes, girls should be educated, but beyond the roles of wives and mothers, because although she agreed that that was women's primary responsibility and role, there were circumstances where women had to look after themselves and take responsibility for themselves or to look after their families. So that prefigured some of the things that happened to her in her life as well. She already knew that women should be independent, but later on, as her marriage unfolded, she was the one who ended up having to be the breadwinner. So she was very aware that even with the best laid plans, there were a lot of women whose lives did not turn out ideally. And so that underpinned her views on girls' education, but also her work with female prisoners. A lot of the women who were in prison were there because they had been deserted by their husbands and they had no money to fall back on. They maybe had resorted to prostitution. And basically, after they'd had a prison sentence, they were often discriminated against and found it very difficult to get employment. So she was very much, her work with female prisoners was around educating them and providing some really practical schemes for them to get employment when they were discharged from prison.
Mary-Ann's actions and interests were, truly international in scope. Most of it was in New Zealand, but she did, venture abroad. Did that kind of international outlook hurt or help her cause?
Well, it's an interesting question because she was connected with a number of international women's movements in terms of the vigilance societies, both in England and back in England and in America as well. And that kept her in touch with some of the leading lights within the women's movement more generally and up to date with the writings and the activism, and particularly around legislation. In terms of her own kind of international profile, it was really the time that she spent in Melbourne, which was about a 16-month period from October 1874 through to January 1876. She was erroneously described then as being from America, Of course, she wasn't, and she'd never been to America. But part of that was because opponents of women's rights often used to refer to Yankee notions. And so they attributed all the radical elements of the women's movement to America, more so than they did to Britain. So in terms of her international profile, she was kind of accused of having views from overseas, and the bad ones, so to speak, were from America. In fact, she was very well read from a range of areas. So it kind of worked to her disadvantage in some respects, but to her advantage personally, because she was well connected and knew that even though she often presented as a lone voice, she had a whole movement of women behind her in other countries.
Mm-hmm. You know, she did have a rough life in many ways. You mentioned her brother dying on the boat coming over. She herself died at 49. You know, does that play into why she was forgotten for so long?
Oh, possibly. I think it's more of it is actually the timing of when she was alive and when she was active, because certainly in New Zealand, the women's movement proper didn't really kick off until the mid-1880s, and that was with the establishment of the Women's Christian Temperance Union in New Zealand. And that provided an opportunity for women to actually group together and have the shared sense of being women and a shared sense of not just identity, but of coming to an understanding of how society treated women as a group differently. And so prior to that, there are individual people who may themselves have been connected with other aspects of the women's movement, but who generally, they might appear in our history books and in the Dictionary of New Zealand Biography, but very little is known about their connections.
I want to ask you about writing a biography. You know, when you chose to do it, how did you use the story of this one person to tell a larger story about New Zealand and about the history of the women's movement and women's history more broadly?
Well, I've written a couple of biographies now, and I absolutely love it as a piece of research, because it does bring all of those different elements in together. To understand anyone's life, whether it's Marianne Coakley or anyone's biography, we really do need to understand the times that they were living in and the different aspects of what was happening that shaped parts of their lives. So as I was writing, I basically, anything that I was doing, I would look up where she was living, for example, and what the situation was like then. Did they have, you know, did they have street lighting? Did they have, you know, gas lighting? What, you know, some of those kinds of things. Because for this particular individual, she's someone who struggled financially all her life, but was a very keen writer. And so that means, and she had children to look after, and she worked full time. So her writing would have probably been done in the evenings, and probably by candlelight. And that causes a real strain on the body. So, you know, you need to actually think through the realities of what it must have been like for people, and to sort of put yourself in their steps, in their shoes, but also in the time period, and understand what society was like at the time, to kind of get a sense of who they are and what their lives were like.
Mm-hmm. You say that you've often wondered whether Marianne had been a contemporary of yours, whether you would have been political allies or perhaps even friends. How do you come down on that question in the end?
I think we wouldn't have been in the same groups. I think probably she would have been a little bit more conservative, although I do generally describe myself as relatively conservative, but to others I'm not. I think she probably would have been the head of the National Council of Women, which is a very, very influential women's group. and very, very active, but active often in the things that we think of as conservative. They do the bread and butter work of submissions to Parliament on various pieces of legislation. They're not generally the ones who are organising rallies and protest marches. So I think Marianne would have been in the National Council of Women Brigade rather than in, say, the more radical groups protesting against, male abuse and all the kind of public protests we see these days.
Jenny, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. That's Jenny Coleman from Massey University. Her new book is Polly Plum, A Firm and Earnest Woman's Advocate, Mary Ann Coakley, 1836 to 1885. It's published by Otago University Press in 2017. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.